And out of all of my favorite Kate songs, this is the hardest one to define because it's such, on the surface, a simple song with simple lyrics, but it's really not. I think for me, it's her performance. Her voice just is magical on this song. And it may not have the most complex musical structure like some of the stuff on Hounds of Love, but just everything, the sound, the production, her voice, the lyrics, the meaning, the mood. It's unbelievable that this is only a B-side.
It's one of those things that kind of slipped between the cracks for me for a long time, even though it's actually a B-side to Running Up That Hill, which is, of course, one of her biggest hits.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like I should have known about it for a long time, but I only really got to know about it maybe 2003, 2004. So there was a lot of stuff going online that I wasn't aware of. And I came across Under the Ivy, and I just loved it instantly because it's just so beautiful. It's just a very straightforward and very simple. Well, this is one of the things I think we need to talk about, is that superficially, at least, it seems like a very simple, a very straightforward and beautiful ballad. But I think there's a lot to it that's really worth investigating and taking the time to enjoy and think about some of those nuances.
Strange Phenomena, the Music of Kate Bush. I'm Cecily Link, and this week we're going to talk about the first B-side of the Hounds of Love season called Under the Ivy, which was the B-side for Running Up That Hill.
It wouldn't take me long to tell you how to find it, to tell you where we'll meet. This little girl inside me, retreating to her favorite place. Go into the garden, go under the ivy, under the leaves, away from your party. Go right to the rose, go right to the white rose.
We've got two guests actually for this episode. We're going to get to hear from
Wayne Henderson from MediaVoiceOvers.com, and I've been waiting a while to get to this song. I love Under the Ivy.
And also, we're calling all the way to England to talk with...
Hello, it's me, Alex Dale.
Yes, and we last had you on in the Never Forever season.
That's right, and I'm delighted to be back. I'm very touched that you would ask me back.
Of course! I love having all sorts of people. So, what is it about Under the Ivy? Kind of what's your personal history with this song?
And out of all of my favorite Kate songs, this is the hardest one to define because it's such, on the surface, a simple song with simple lyrics, but it's really not. I think for me, it's her performance. Her voice just is magical on this song. And it may not have the most complex musical structure like some of the stuff on Hounds of Love, but just everything, the sound, the production, her voice, the lyrics, the meaning, the mood. It's unbelievable that this is only a B-side. But I tell you, this time period of Kate Bush during the Hounds of Love and even onto the next album, she was so prolific. I mean, the B-sides, there's enough for a whole album there, and, you know, alternate versions and dance mixes and just all this stuff. She was just a machine, a fabulously magic machine during this time.
And I think a lot of that, why there are so many B-sides and alternate versions for this season, is because this was the season where she had her own home studio. So she could just record whenever and however she wanted. And so she could just record to her heart's content. And that's probably why there are so many B-sides on this season. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. And so many of them are fantastic. And Under the Ivy, wow. Just, oh wait, that's another Kate Bush song. Sorry.
So what was it like for you the first time you heard Under the Ivy? How did you first hear it?
I first heard it because a record store in the area where I used to live always got their shipments of imports and U.S. releases on particular days. And so we'd always chat with the manager there because he actually, considering there was no real internet happening at that time, he was kind of in the know with upcoming stuff. And he kept telling us, oh, this Hounds of Love album from Kate Bush, she's going to go commercial. You're going to be blown away. I'm hearing great things. And we should get the lead single, you know, Running Up That Hill anytime. And so I knew what day it was going to come out, went and got it. And the first time I heard Under the Ivy was rushing home with that album, with that single, and just putting it on the stereo, putting on my headphones, and just soaking it in. I was like, new Kate Bush. I couldn't wait because it was such a long wait, so to speak, from the Dreaming mm-hmm. till this album. And I just wanted to soak up every song. And so I just wore that single out.
That's a really good question, because it's one of those things that kind of slipped between the cracks for me for a long time, even though it's mm-hmm. actually a B-side to Running Up That Hill, which is, of course, one of our biggest hits.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like I should have known about it for a long time, but I only really got to know about it maybe 2003, 2004, because I went back to university during that time and I was doing a master's. And it was the first time that I had proper internet connection. So I was really exploiting it for everything I could, just to find B-sides, obscure tracks, all of the demos that what are the names of those demos now?
Some they call them like the Kathy demos or exactly. the Phoenix demos. Yeah, yeah.
So there was a lot of stuff going online that I wasn't aware of. And I came across Under the Ivy, and I just loved it instantly because it's just so beautiful. It's just a very straightforward and very simple. Well, this is one of the things I think we need to talk about, is that superficially, at least, it seems like a very simple, a very straightforward and beautiful ballad. But I think there's a lot to it that's really worth investigating and taking the time to enjoy and think about some of those nuances. What about you? What's your story with this song?
Well, I first heard this probably when I had my husband find the files for the two discs of rarities from the This Woman's Work box set. Because until then, I was only familiar with, let's see, I had The Dreaming at that point. I had Hounds of Love. I also had the Red Shoes album. So I really only knew the album cuts. And I was aware that this song existed. And people thought, oh my gosh, it's one of my favorite songs. It's one of her best. Da, 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 da. And so I kind of like had it built in my head, like, okay, this song is supposed to be like one of her best. And it's a B-side. And so when I listened to it for the first time, it was probably about 2008-ish. And at that time, I was coming out of college. I was also like getting into a lot more of the singer-songwriters, like Tori Amos I was getting into at the time as well. But Kate, of course, has stuck with me a little bit longer and more consistently than Tori has. And when I heard this song, I realized why people loved it so much. I realized, wow, she's got this kind of intense emotional story in less than 2.5 minutes. And as I've seen in some of her other B-sides, like, say, Warm and Soothing, which is also a piano and vocal track, that there is a lot within just those, like, 2 minutes. And also, like, the melody is kind of, it's very plaintive. It sounds like somebody mourning something that they can't have anymore. And over the years, this song has especially resonated with me, and it's now actually risen to my top 10. Of Hooray. Songs. It is ranked at number 6. It's because, like, I've realized kind of as I've gotten older that, you know, there are things that I don't get to do anymore, that I kind of like miss. I sometimes miss the childlike innocence that I used to have, and now I feel like I'm a cynical 34-year-old about a lot of things. And
oh, man. Like, you're talking to a cynical 44-year-old.
So it feels like it's such a lament, and also, especially like this year, I've been going through a lot of changes and doing a lot of growing. And this song, for me, feels like somebody like losing something that they used to have and they wish they still had.
Yeah.
And like you're trying to slip away from someplace, like, you know, away from the party. And in a way, it reminds me vaguely, like thematically, at least, certainly not musically, of Somewhere Only We Know by Keane. Because that song, because that song like feels like, you know, we're like, you know, and if you have a minute, why don't we go talk about it somewhere only we know? And it's all about like growing up and like getting away from the harshness of life. And so thematically, this song reminds me a little bit of Somewhere Only We Know. Oh, that's one of my favorite Keane songs. Oh, my gosh.
Oh, I always come away with more stuff to listen to after talking to you. This is okay. So, just as an aside, how many of your favorite songs is this now that you can talk about? So, I think you talked, because I've been trying to, I haven't managed to listen to all of your episodes, but I know you've certainly mentioned a couple of your favorite songs so far.
Yes. So, so number one is Cloud Busting.
Ah.
Yeah. Okay. That is like my absolute, absolute favorite. Cloud Busting. I know that Wow is in there too. Night of the Swallow. Ne t'en fuis pas, that's right. Ne t'en fuis pas is number three.
That was a very good episode as well. I enjoyed that one.
Number four is Night of the Swallow. Five is Wow. And now number six is Under the Ivy. Oh, and number seven is Running Up That Hill.
Okay. So that's a very good single to own. Back to back there.
I know.
An A side and a B side.
Because, yes, I've ranked this one like one slot above Running Up That Hill, but this Running Up That Hill used to be my absolute favorite Kate song. And it's kind of slipped a little bit because I've gotten more into her music and just there's more of her stuff that resonates with me, and especially this song. And this is also a beautiful song to play on piano. Speaking of piano, we are about to hear a portion of a piano instrumental transcribed by ear by the YouTube user Yanta. Yanta is best known for doing Tori Amos transcriptions, but he has a few originals, and he has a few transcriptions from our lovely British songstress, including this week's song. So here's part of Yanta's version of Under the Ivy. You can support him at patreon.com/Yanta. Reasons why this is one of my favorite, why this is one of my top 10 favorites. I have a lot of a personal connection to this song because for me, it's about wanting to just retreat from the world, to just get away from everybody else, maybe for no real reason. You just need to get away for a while. And I know Kate has said, and we'll talk about this, that Kate has said that, oh, this, she wrote this to be about somebody, like going to meet somebody, or that you're trying to do something you used to do when you were a kid, or you used to do a lot when you were younger and you're afraid you can't do it anymore. And I know for me, I'm very extroverted, obviously on this podcast, but in truth, I'm quite an introvert, and that I kind of need to retreat for a while and just engage with my creative side, like get away, you know, away from the party. I need to get away from the hustle and bustle of the world and retreat to my own favorite place, whether it's honestly editing this podcast or sitting in front of my piano and just creating. And that's something that's become very important to me, is having that creative space and just retreating from the world for a while. And I never understood when I was a teenager that I would get really snappy. I mean, I was being a bitchy teenager, but I would get like mean with people. If I was up in my room and my parents would knock on the door and I was in the middle of writing a song or doing something creative, and I would just be like, "Ah, what do you want?" kind of thing. And it was because, oh my God, I was in this like this headspace, this creative thing where I was just so focused, and instead like somebody's pulling me out of it. And I never understood until I was older that, oh, it's because you're an introvert. Duh. And I just didn't know what that meant. And so for me, this song really strikes a chord because, you know, this is somebody else. You know, Kate is somebody else who, like me, has to step away from the world and just engage with something that she loves to do. And she leaves it ambiguous as to what it is. You know, it's not easy for me to give away a secret. It's not safe. We don't know, okay, what is this secret? You're just kind of like, let your own interpretation. And for me, it's that I have to be in this creative space. And this song really hits me because Kate understands that need to be introverting for a while. And I've been rambling, but that's the purpose of a podcast, to ramble, really.
And I definitely see your point on that. And I saw a quote from Kate recently where she said that she wrote this song very quickly and It was just a simple piano vocal and it was easy to record. So sometimes things don't have to be too complex, and sometimes the song just comes to you. It's interesting that a song like this with fairly straightforward lyrics can be interpreted so many different ways.
No matter
what the performer says that her initial idea was for the song, no matter what Kate says, there's so many ways to look at it. And like you said, some of the lyrics are pretty vague and pretty mysterious.
Mm-hmm. I mean, what does she mean by the white? What is the significance of the white rose? I mean, she repeats that quite a bit in the song. You know, go right to the white rose. When, what does that signify? We don't know. It's up to us to interpret that how we will, you know?
Yeah, and like you said, you cruise around on the internet to gaffa.org and other places, and you see other fans that have interpreted, and they go back to some ancient meanings to the white rose and things like that, and how that might play into the song. But It definitely puts a lot of visuals in your mind. You can picture this playing out, even if it's just straightforward getting away from a party and a big group of people and going to a private place from your childhood or something like that. You can definitely get that vision in your mind. I can see the colors. I can see the plants, the shrubbery, whatever. I can see it all in my head.
Something else that really strikes me, you know, like especially about this song, is the line that this little girl inside me is retreating to her favorite place. I'm reminded of a quote. It's a quote from Kate about how she used to love dancing in front of the TV when she was a child. And then somebody came into the room and pointed and laughed at her because they thought that she was dancing really weird. And that she's been trying to get back to that innocent little girl who would just dance in front of the TV and not worry about what people thought of her, that she feels like she's always trying to get back to that place. And so that this little girl inside me is retreating to her favorite place makes me think of that quote of that, you know, you're trying to get back to the innocence that you once felt when you were a child, when you really didn't give a shit about anything. And you just did it because you just did something because you loved it.
Those are magical times when we're young, and then when you get a magical track like this, and even though it's issued as a B-side, and I always try to imagine where on Hounds of Love would this have worked, and I'm sure Kate looked at 20 or 30 different angles. I think just right at the end of side one or at the very beginning of side two, it could work, but, you know, we don't want to take away from Kate's wisdom, but I just wish even more people could hear it. It's great that it's available now in the remastered box sets and this woman's work, and so people that may not have the actual Running Up That Hill single, everybody needs to hear this song, especially
And speaking of the remasters, I understand now you've got the remasters, and it's also on the Other Sides, which was released earlier this year, and I know it's all been remastered, and you say you've got a copy of those, correct?
I had to, even though I had heard all of the tracks on the other sides before, you know, except for, of course, we finally get the full version of Passing Through Air. We'd heard part of that before, but it's so fantastic to have that full version. Mm-hmm. There was one or two tracks that I had only seen or heard through, you know, maybe a video clip, so never in great sound quality. But I can tell you that I hear a lot more things on some of these tracks after Kate Bush remastered them. So many of them sound so different. Even that remixed version of Running Up That Hill that she did for the Olympics. I hear things in there that I didn't hear before. But back to Under the Ivy, of course, that was one of the first go-to tracks. I'm like, okay, I got this podcast recording coming up. Got these new remasters, these new CDs. Let's plug it in. It sounds great. I mean, there's only so much you could probably remaster with a song that's basically Kate and her piano, but you can hear the difference. Her voice is just stellar. The piano, at least to me, it feels like I'm in the room with the piano. But it always did sound great. It's just nice to have a little bit more sparkle in it, I guess.
From a 1985 interview with Kate Bush by Doug Allen. I read an interview where the interviewer asked you if Running Up That Hill is about the contemplation of suicide. And I thought that was pretty amusing because it seemed to me clearly not to be about any such thing at all. On the other hand, strangely enough, that's just what Under the Ivy seems to be about to me. The tone of the song is very, very sad, and it seems to be about longing for the lost innocence of youth. Perhaps a follow-up to In Search of Peter Pan, a white rose is a strong image in the song. And it could be a symbol for friendship or innocence, but it could also be a symbol for death. You sing away from the party, and it seems like you might almost mean away from the problems and triviality of modern-day life. You sing, it wouldn't take me long to tell you how to find it. And it seems like you might be almost addressing death itself. You mention a secret, but never mention what it is. Could it be the taboo we have of suicide? What are your feelings about this interpretation, and what were your intentions with the song? Kate, well, I think perhaps you're reading much more into it than was originally intended when I wrote it. It's very much a song about someone who is sneaking away from a party to meet someone elusively, secretly, and to possibly make love with them, or just to communicate. But it's secret, and it's something they used to do and that they won't be able to do again. It's about a nostalgic, revisited moment. Doug, is there any reason why it's so sad? Kate, I think it's sad because it's about someone who is recalling a moment when perhaps they used to do it when they were innocent and when they were children, and it's something that they're having to sneak away to do privately now as adults. Yeah, it's her piano. I mean, I'm guessing there's probably only three tracks really on this entire song. You get the piano and her main vocal, and then her background vocal, where it sounds like it's been recorded in a tunnel, but they probably just put a lot of reverb on it. For me, right after, you know, go right to the white rose, and then a little bit of piano, and then for me. I love that part.
It's great that they did release the other sides, you know, the B-sides, the 12-inch dance mixes, and you know, some of the cover songs in their own little set, so you don't have to be daunted with the fact that you have to buy one of the huge remastered collections of all the other albums when some of these tracks some people may not have. So at the time I bought it, all four CDs in that little set, it was only like $26 on Amazon, and every penny.
Oh, and of course, I love that the title for this song was also the title of Graham Thompson's biography that has been cited so much on this show. It's like with some of her earlier B-sides that were piano vocal only as well, that were like nice and short like this. Like one of my absolute favorites, Warm and Soothing, where that song is just, I think it barely lasts 2 minutes, 40 seconds. And it's like Under the Ivy, it's just simple, like, oh yeah, I'm just going to set the piano and just bang out this absolutely gorgeous song and make you all melt and, oh God, my God.
Yeah, that one is, I listened to that one just today on the way home from work, and thought about, you know, her and her piano, but just how much higher everything is in that, the key, the vocals, everything. And it was just a couple of years before doing Under the Ivy. So much changes so quick in the world of Kate Bush, at least during the 80s. Do you know of any demos that are out there or anything else?
For this song, no. I get the impression that Kate went, okay, I'm gonna write and record this thing pretty quickly and just release it as it is, not even touched up. I mean, she doesn't need any other instrumentation on this song. Like, it's perfect as it is. It's like 2 minutes of just her at the piano doing what she had always done and doesn't need any other bells and whistles.
Yeah, I feel that we're lucky to have this song because it's truly one of my favorites, and the chatter I've seen in the different Kate Bush groups on Facebook and mentions on Twitter as well, I'm not alone. At first, I thought I was one of the few that really liked that song, but thanks to the internet, I know I'm not alone.
Well, and when I first started getting into Kate stuff, and like I was hearing, like, oh yeah, Under the Ivy, that's her best B-side. Oh my gosh, it's absolute. Like, I knew pretty early on that, wow, this is a big fan favorite. And, you know, like I said, it snuck up on me. But a lot, honestly, Kate is just that kind of artist for me. Like, I'll just one day I'll go, oh my gosh, this is one of my favorites. How did I not hear this before? And that was the case with this one.
I mean, just how do I pick just a couple of lines that are...
I know. Well, there aren't very many lines at all.
But I mean, even the part leading up to the giving away a secret where Kate sings about, I sit there, or sorry, screwed that up.
I sit here in the thunder.
Yeah, I sit here in the thunder, the green on the gray. I feel it all around me, and it's not easy for me to give away a secret. It's not safe. But every single line in this song means something. And even just the way the song ends with, it wouldn't take me long to tell you how to find it. And it just kind of, in a way, fades, not like fading out the music, but just that last chord just goes. And the interpretations of all the different things, because there's so many, it's sometimes hard to have your own interpretation, because they've covered everything from death. Heard an interpretation that this is actually one of Kate's most sexual song.
Well, I guess we can kind of talk about the lyrics, because I think the lyrics feel both personal and impersonal at the same time.
Yeah. I think that's a very good observation, because like a lot of her songs, it isn't her. At least it's very tempting to believe it's about her, because she always writes with a very voice. Mm-hmm. You know, it wouldn't take me long, and it's in her very specific vocal style as well, in her voice, so it sounds like it's coming from her. But I wonder how autobiographical it is, and also to me as well, it kind of conjures up when she's talking about her garden and so on. If you know her kind of story a little bit, you know she grew up on a farmhouse and she recorded in a studio in the farmhouse. So there's a very specific set of imagery that goes with it that mm-hmm. makes it sound like it ought to be autobiographical as well, I think. But I do wonder how much you can distance herself from it and just write it about... Well, the funny thing is, what it reminded me of a little bit as well was something like Far From the Madding Crowd, like a piece of English, you know, classic literature, because she does that as well. She will always, not always, but very often kind of refer to a kind of literary background or a filmic background. And that kind of rural English idiom and imagery, and particularly a storm. Have you read Far From the Madding Crowd?
I have not. That was more of an AP, advanced placement English kind of thing when I was in high school, so I didn't get a chance to read it, but I've heard about it.
Okay.
And, yeah.
I don't know if it's a reference or not, but there's a specific scene where the two main characters have to save a haystack in the middle of a storm, and it reminds me of that. So the thunder and the lightning in this rural, this kind of rural setting, it's a very, to me, it's a very English set, picture set, and very English set of imagery.
Well, and nice gardens also especially come up a lot in her work, like like in Frightened Eyes, one of my favorite demos that I really wish that she had fleshed out. She mentions, you know, and there's a line about in any English country gardens, or in something like a song, she's talking about something being out in her garden, and so it gardens play a very big role in her songs, and I'm not surprised that this kind of ended up in a song that she started writing in her home studio where she's back at home with her family, and it's a much more lively environment than when she recorded The Dreaming, where she was going from studio to studio and she was kind of away from her family for a while.
Yeah.
And she probably wrote this like playing the piano and looking out the window at the big sky. Yeah. That.
It's nice to imagine, isn't it? Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that's very true. And I think there's probably almost a whole study you could do just about the gardens in her work. As you say, something that sounds like a song in my garden. Mm-hmm. It's the same to me, it's always the same garden, I think. I don't know whether it's intended to be or not. Or I had another good example, but there's lots of, I think, this song, I think, reminds me a little bit of Never Be Mine off The Sensual World, which is probably coming up, but it has a lot of it, kind of similar reference points as well. So it has, so that song refers to the cornfields being set fire to, which again is kind of pastoral imagery. And then a lot of the kind of harmonies are these very open, unstable, unresolved pieces of harmonies that are moving in the background as well.
Yes, especially with the way the melody moves, because I mean, in this version, it starts in G minor, but the first note is F.
Yeah.
It's, and she's actually done that quite a bit in the songs from Hounds of Love, that she'll start on a note that's like, she's not starting on the tonic, she's starting like the tone below, and so you kind of, it kind of feels a little destabilizing in a way.
Yes, it's kind of wobbly. Yeah. And that's one of the things I think that makes it so lovely and so beautiful, this song, is exactly that. And then the thing that's quite subtle, I think, is that only happens at the beginning and the end of the song as well. So it's that opening chord, with, which is, I think, a suspended fourth. So it's got the C rather than the B flat. And then the vocal, as you say, is on the F. Mm-hmm. So it's a really open, kind of wobbly, tentative harmony. But then as it gains pace, I think, become more conventional. So it's going down through the F and the E flat and so on. But then at the end, I think it resolves on like a, to tell you where to find me, is another suspended chord at the end as well. So it comes full circle back to this slightly unstable, tentative, very longing quality. As she's singing the verse, the melody is leading, the chord changes ever so slightly. So the words are like a quarter of a beat, just faster than the chord that's changing underneath. Wouldn't take me long, and then it changes, to tell you where to find it, and then it changes, and so on.
It wouldn't take me long to tell you how to find it, to tell you where we'll be. Girl inside me is retreating to her favorite place.
For the chorus, go into the garden, go down under the leaves, away from the party. Suddenly they line up and it's much more assertive and a deliberate choice.
And certainly the way she's also playing piano at that part, it's more like block chords. Whereas before it's, you know, da 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 da, like it's a little bit more flowing, and then she da da da, go into the garden, go under the ivy.
And it's gone from this kind of arpeggiated to, as you say, these more kind of blocky, more dramatic. Maybe.
Go into the garden, go under the ivy, under the leaves, away from the party, go right to the rose, go right to the white rose.
And considering that there aren't like too many chord changes in the song, that like it's that G, it's like G minor, F, B, E flat, and then B flat, F, G minor. That's pretty much throughout the whole song. And so like changing that up like that makes it more interesting. It's not just the same thing for 2 minutes.
And after hearing so many of the songs, you know, on Never Forever, and then the production and the songs on The Dreaming, to have, you know, Running Up That Hill, it was very cool. Love that song as well, but you know, it has a lot of different elements in production to it. But you listen to Under the Ivy, and I think one of my first thoughts was, oh my goodness, this is amazing. It's just Kate and a piano, just like the old days. I'm going to soak it in. And like you said, only about 2 minutes. So, okay, we'll start it over. Let's hear this again.
Yeah. And, you know, speaking of like her at the piano, I love that this is just her at her piano, you know, retreating to her favorite place, the piano, like she did when she was a kid before all the whirlwind of fame. She would just sit at her piano and just lose herself in the music. And yes, I know I started to quote an Eminem thing there, but it was completely unintentional. It's a good song.
So I've listened to a lot of your Hounds of Love episodes so far, and people have pointed out, I think quite rightly, that they're very rhythmic songs. The Dreaming, starting all the way back in Never Forever, where she buys a beatbox, and you can start to see that happen. And then for The Dreaming, the rhythm becomes more important. And then Hounds of Love, there are sometimes almost no harmonies, just kind of wobbling backwards and forwards between two very open-ended chords while the big drums are going on. This is actually quite a nice contrast to that, and reminds me in some ways of a very early piano ballad work, just very straightforward, unaffected. So she can still do that too, and she can probably, it sounds like she just did it in an afternoon as well, which is very annoying.
I know.
Yeah. And it's one of her best songs, and she just knocks it out, you know. Yeah, it could be connected all the way back to In My Garden, you know, or looking forward to, I think, a lot of the 50 Words for Snow starts to become very pianistic again and very harmonic again. So it's interesting. It's always there while she's doing all of the big rhythmic and sampling and, you know, layering of vocals and stuff like this.
And it's a good contrast to the A side.
Yeah. You know, it didn't even occur to me, but you're absolutely right. Yeah.
Because the A side is so, it's Running Up That Hill. I mean, who doesn't know that song by now? And then you get this on the B side that's so simple. It's like, it's like the for The Dreaming when you had the Sat in Your Lapis lead single, and then the B side was Lord of the Reedy River.
Yeah, I think that's quite interesting, isn't it? So she's good at putting out an A side, which is really pioneering and interesting and unusual and quite challenging, actually. And then the B sides are where the more not conventional, but you know, maybe more, not even mainstream. I'm struggling to find a nice,
or maybe acoustic almost.
Perhaps, yeah, maybe more balladeering. I don't know.
This is something that's completely different.
Yes, contrasting. Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, there we go. Contrasting. Like, what's the word? I don't know. I'm starting to think of French words. I'm like, ah, no, stay in English.
What would be a French good French word for this phenomenon? I don't know.
I guess quelque chose de différent, something different.
Yeah. Quelque chose qui différence. Okay.
Yeah, this is just, and it's got just some really pretty imagery in here too. I mean, we were talking about the gardens, like go under the ivy. It feels very, like, very mysterious, because ivy is such a, a plant. It just wants to go everywhere. It's like mint. It's like, it just wants to take over.
And well, I think ivy is evergreen as well. Is it? Is that right? So ivy is enduring, I think. So gardens are seasonal and ivy is enduring. This is just occurring to me now, thinking about it and why this is interesting. The ivy has a direct connection to the past through a garden that's changing and has been tended and has a cycle growing on top of it. All the things that kind of resonate, that sound like that resonate with you and that you're talking about, that idea of growing and maturing. And the ivy is the constant there that's going on through that. It's always with this stuff, I do wonder how much of this she's thought about consciously and how much of this just appeals to her artistic imagination because she's just tuned into that kind of thing. I don't know.
I like to think that that she comes up with the melody first and then like puts in the words, because I've read some quotes from her that when she first started writing songs that she would come up with melodies, but coming up with lyrics was a little bit more difficult.
Mm.
And so I wonder if sometimes she just chooses this phrase because it sounds cool.
Yeah, it could be. Yeah, and it wouldn't surprise me, because I think the way that the story is put together is very interesting, lyrically speaking.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting, because with Kate Bush, you know, almost everything, every little element of a song or a lyric has purpose to her. And it's just interesting that this song, like you said, just a little over 2 minutes, the first line of this brief song is, "It wouldn't take me long to tell you how to find it." So letting you know right up front, this is going to be quick and to the point, but settle in. Yeah.
And even her vocal delivery on that line, especially, is like very, it's kind of hushed and like detached. Like you're kind of feeling like maybe she's leaning in and trying to whisper to you in a way, and even though she's not whispering, but it's very soft and very detached. Like, it wouldn't take me long to tell you how to find it. It almost feels like kind of Morse code a little bit.
And it definitely gets your attention right off the bat. This is so good. I'm going to have to hear it again and again.
I know. Me too. Yes. Maybe I'll even like dig out the sheet music and play on piano. I used to be able to I could do it from memory, and it's been a couple of years because I've been doing other stuff, but yeah, it's just, oh my gosh, this is such a beautiful song. I could go on for hours about this.
So I'm just thinking about that opening line. Let me think now. Yeah, so it wouldn't take me long to tell you how to find it, to tell you where we'll meet.
It wouldn't take me long to tell you how to find it, to tell you where we'll meet.
The image that this conjures up to me is that this is like an internal monologue of this character talking to somebody, trying to talk to somebody else, almost psychically across a room. So because that imagery is there of this party, the song mentions a party later on, you've got to go away from this party, which gives me shivers when she sings that, because I get that a lot. You know, alone in a crowd is such an interesting idea and such a common experience, I think, that a lot of people have. And she manages to express that very beautifully. And then the desire for like a genuine intimacy. So you know, somebody somebody actually knows, that she can tell, it's just almost, maybe she makes eye contact with this person and just kind of gives it a roll of the eyes, like, let's go under the ivy. I don't know. You see, this is the danger of, this is why interpreting it makes it sound crass, right?
But it feels like you're in this crowded place and you kind of want to get away with somebody you love. Mm. And maybe you used to go to this secret place, and yeah, this little girl inside me is retreating to her favorite place. Maybe her favorite place is like retreating into her head. Okay, like, I'm done being around all these people. I'm done. I need to go introvert for a while. Let's go get away.
This little girl inside me is retreating to her favorite place. Go into the garden. Go under the ivy.
Away from the party.
that's absolutely it, I think. And it's about an assignation. If that's because somebody asked me, so what's this song about? And I said, that's the first thing that came into my head. It's about an assignation. It's about somebody who wants to meet somebody else, mm-hmm. for a real connection. And, you know, like all of her work, so much of her, well, you know, there's that real core theme to everything she does. It's about trying to make connections with people, mm-hmm. and building bridges and communication and the difficulties of that. And this, I think, is another really interesting facet of that.
And certainly, like you were mentioning, yes. like feeling alone in a crowd, that yes. I sit here in the thunder, the green on the gray, I feel it all around me. I feel like that's about like it goes back to being at this party and there's lots of noise and it's all this stuff going on and you're feeling kind of just need to get away and everything.
I heard that slightly differently, and in my imagination, it was like just basically that kind of static electricity you get in the air before a thunderstorm. Ooh. This storm brewing. So she's sitting, I think, in a gut. This is one of the things I think that makes this very such an English song, and I'd love to hear your take on this being transatlantic, because there's such a specific green on gray, and the way she mentions it is really a very beautiful word picture immediately. But so I've been to the States a bit, and I've been seeing various bits of it, but I've not seen all of it. But I've never come across this very particular kind of summery day that you get in England, where it's a solid gunmetal gray sky with a storm in it, and then green, very specific green trees blowing on top of it. Mm-hmm. So that's all you need to say is the green and the gray, and immediately it evokes this thunderstorm. And it's like that very much now, actually. And so in my apartment, we have a shared garden down at the bottom, and I go down and I feed the cat and, you know, sit on a bench, and I can see this phenomenon right in front of me, and I'm reminded of it every time, the trees blowing and the stormy sky. And it's such a distinct suburban image, mm-hmm. quality. And I've seen a lot of fascinating kind of effects, kind of visual effects in America, but they're a different scale. So, you know, I've been to Salt Lake City, and I've seen the Wasatch Mountains, but it's such a different kind of experience of what a landscape is. Like, it's mm-hmm. huge, the horizon is miles away, and the sky is different, and the air quality is different.
Yeah.
I don't know. Sorry, this feels like a tangent, but at the same time, it feels very particular. And I don't know. I'd be really curious to know whether that kind of imagery translates, or whether you get something different from it. You know, what does that conjure up for you? You know.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned the landscapes, because yeah, in the United States, we're such a large country that every region looks different. It's like you were mentioning, like, yeah. I've been out west, and it is like the skies feel like they just go on and on and on for ages.
Yeah.
Or if you go out to, if you go into New England, that feels a little different. It's a lot of green in New England. Lots and lots of green. Like, I've been up to upstate New York. In Massachusetts, I've been to Maine. I remember going up there, and it was 50 degrees in July, and it kind of threw me off. I was 10 years old. I was like, why is it cold in the summer? And mom having to explain climate to her 10-year-old daughter. does conjure up. What's that?
You mean 50 degrees Fahrenheit?
Oh, 50 degrees Fahrenheit. Yes, sorry. Which I guess would be
still very cold, right?
I guess maybe 15 degrees Celsius?
Okay.
Maybe?
I have no idea.
I don't know.
The one imperial measurement I have absolutely no grasp on, sorry. I can do feet and inches quite easily.
Well, I just wish we were all on the same temperature scale. Anyway, but it does, I see what you mean about the landscapes, because there are, for me, at least what I've seen of the U.S., like I've been out west, I've been to the north, and where I live around here, it is like the skies are not very blue. It's very hazy because it's so humid here. We're kind of a subtropical here in Southern Virginia. So the skies and the colors to me are a lot different. I see a lot more gray, I think. And even if when you go out to the Atlantic, well, there are days where they tell people to not go and swim in the Atlantic. And it's not really like this deep blue that you might imagine in other regions.
Why not swim in the Atlantic? Is that too cold?
Not really too cold, but just sometimes you'll get weird fungus that come in.
Oh my God.
Yeah, like from some of the pollution, because it is such a, our region is very industrial. It's okay. A lot of shipbuilding and get like big shipping. You'll see out way out in the distance, you'll see these ships with big shipping containers on top of them.
Okay.
Like when I pass, one of the tunnels going into Norfolk, like you look off and you can see all the shipping containers, like from all around the world. You get like Maersk and China shipping, all sorts of stuff. It's very industrial. So the colors around here are not exactly, it's a lot more gray. You don't really see a lot of green.
Okay.
But it's true, like different regions have like their different feel to them.
This reminds me as well, I sit here in the thunder. Now, there's some dispute over the meaning of this line. I don't know if you've come across this argument. So there's a pictorial, Kate Bush, a visual documentary by Mays and Can. So because I was trying to find as much interesting stuff as I could about this. Now, they make this assertion, which I think is a little bit ridiculous, but this is what they claim anyway, is that the thunder is the thunderbox, which is an outdoor toilet. Yeah.
No, just no.
No, I don't think so either. I don't know why you would. I mean, even if that were true, which I don't think it is, why would you interpret it that way? When you, it's there's such a much more beautiful interpretation that lends itself much more readily to the song, I think. So I Feel It All Around Me is just about the gathering storm, or maybe the crowd of the party. It doesn't, you know. Why does it have to be a bathroom joke, really?
Yeah, really.
No. There are some idiots out there.
She has a lot of different colors. I've noticed, like, and I've just kind of thought of this, that, you know, the green on the gray, go to the white rose.
That's, yeah, yeah.
And
I didn't notice that either, but you're quite right.
But I honestly just noticed, I'm like, oh, wait. To me, green on the gray, it goes into... I think how to explain it. I think of green on the gray as like she's in the middle of this party with all these people, and she's feeling like, oh my God, I'm getting really peopled out. I need to just get the hell away. And so the thunder is like all the party and all the people, the talking, and that the green on the gray is like her, because green is, when I think of green, I think of innocence. A little bit. I think of like when somebody is green, like they're new at something, they're young, fresh. Okay. And so I think of her innocence, like trying to creep in over the gray of like her mind and just like, like feeling all stormy, you know, and it's not easy for me to give away a secret. It's not safe. It's not easy for me to let on who I really am or how I really feel, because I'm with all these people and I need to just escape for a bit.
And it's not easy for me to give away your secret. It's not safe, but go into the gun. Go under the ivy, under the leaves, away from the party. Go right to the rose, go right.
I mean, I can see why it has so many interpretations, because one, people love to interpret stuff. I mean, that's what this podcast is for. But also just that it is so vague. Like, you know, I feel it all around me. What is the it? To give away a secret, it's not safe. Well, what is the secret? Or white rose, like white rose, it has to mean something. And to me, I just think it's about somebody wanting to escape to their own private retreat and just get away from the world for a while. And
for all we know, maybe growing up, Kate had a garden in the backyard out mm-hmm. near the back, and maybe there was a particular white rose that she always remembers. And it's just that straightforward.
I never heard it that way, but that makes a lot of sense now that you, yeah, that's very nice.
And then it goes into when she talks about the white rose, that a white rose is the symbolism of that is purity and innocence.
Yes. That's a more obvious one, I think. But yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. But sorry, you were saying, what do you think is...
Yeah, but, you know, go to the white rose, go right to the white rose, I'll be waiting for you. Because it's a song, and it's about, like getting back to your something you used to do when you were a kid, when you were innocent.
Yes. That sounds entirely plausible to me and sounds like a good reading of this. And because that's exactly the sense that I get from it as well. It is about a kind of longing, nostalgic longing. A mm-hmm. longing for something that's gone that you can't get back. Yeah, for sure. And child and innocence is definitely one of those things, or maybe an agreement with a child, with an old childhood friend, something that, yeah, maybe the relationship has stayed, but the content has changed because, you know, people mature. And mm-hmm. But this is so interesting because it's such a simple song, but it lends itself to all of these different ways of thinking about it and reading it, I think, and hearing different layers in it.
Yeah.
And all she does is, I think, just listen to the muse and, as you say, find the melody and find the chords, and then the whole thing suggests itself. So, yeah, I think because she is a very suburban artist, and UK suburbs, I think, from my subjective experience of these things, are quite different from American ones. So there's a kind of cultural stereotype almost of what an American suburb is like, with this white picket fence, and it's almost like a David Lynch, slightly odd, maybe, I don't know. And I think the way that maybe class is understood is a little bit different as well. So the middle class means something slightly different, and I think Kate is of the English middle class, so her dad was a doctor. So they were quite well off, and they were quite insulated, and in the scheme of things, probably, not wealthy, but you know, certainly grounded and, you know, safe. And I think that's partly what gave her the creative freedom to do what she does, which is really great.
Absolutely.
And it also gives her a very specific frame of reference, which I think is one of the great things about her work, actually, is that she can turn very ordinary, domestic and middle-of-the-road things, like somebody, you know, in a party, but she can make it sound really interesting and just peel back all the layers on it, because that's what she works with. Let me think now. Yeah, so these are UK suburbs, I think, and they're not a bungalow with huge acres around them and, you know, crickets or mm-hmm. whatever you get, or they're quite a small house with several stories and ivy and red brick and maybe a driveway, that kind of thing. It's a bit Miss Marple. Imagine like a, you know,
mm-hmm.
it's an element of truth to these stereotypes, unfortunately. And but she can take those images and make them really, really sing and really fresh again, I think, which is really nice.
It's interesting that we don't have an actual, you know, video for the song. You know, like, she was heavy into doing the concept videos at this time. Mm-hmm. We just have, well, not just because this is stellar to have, the live performance of it that she did for that television show back in the day. And the way at the very end, after the last note, where she just looks up and smiles with satisfaction mm-hmm. is just... Yeah, you nailed it, Kate. You nailed it.
Yeah, I was watching that actually earlier today, because I know it's been, earlier this year, it was uploaded to Kate Bush's official YouTube channel, and it's supposed to be in higher quality, or as best quality as they can get. And so I was looking into that performance because I've seen it before. And I always thought it was honestly kind of random. Well, this is a B-side and she's performing it on TV. I wonder why this particular one, or she must have just been really fond of it. I mean, why not? I was looking into that. It was on a TV show called The Tube, the 100th episode of it, and it was broadcast on March 19th, 1986, and it's the only time that this song has been performed live. And me being music nerd, as I was listening to this, I thought, this sounds a little bit brighter. That's because this song in this live version is actually sung a half step up, because I actually have, I have sheet music for Under the Ivy, because it's actually really easy to play on piano. It's really not that hard. A lot of Kate Bush's music, quite a few of her songs are difficult to play. Like, I would never attempt to play Wuthering Heights, for example. I would never even attempt to sing that. But something like Under the Ivy is actually not that hard to play on piano with just a little bit of practice. And the sheet music on that is in G minor, which itself is a nice moody key. Not as much as, say, B flat minor, but it's still moody. And this one, it sounded brighter. And I thought, okay. And so I started picking out, because I know the melody, and so I picked it out on the piano. And it was, oh my goodness, this is half a step up in G sharp minor, which itself is another kind of moody key. But I found it interesting that she performed it a little bit higher than on the recorded version, I guess to like give us something a little different, perhaps. But I thought that was a nice little touch that she felt confident enough in herself performing on TV. And you know what? I'm going to sing this just a little bit higher, because why not?
That is a great catch. Now I need to go watch it again, because I noticed the sound being different, but I just took that to be the recording technology at the time or what have you. But that's amazing. And you're right. It would take confidence, especially since it's just her piano and live. And it's fantastic. And I'm glad and thankful for not only the official Kate Bush YouTube channel, but the fact that they post some of these videos in here when they find them good enough quality, because the version that I had way back in the day was a VHS copy of a VHS copy that was probably copied from a Betamax copy, and the sound was muddy, the picture was muddy and kept getting skewed. And so this is a treasure, and I'm glad we get to watch it. Now I have to watch it again and really pay attention to the key, because I have been playing the track quite a few times this week leading up to our discussion we're having. And so I should instantly notice the difference after hearing it that many times.
Well, it was striking to me, and it just moving it up to that just a little bit higher, like just gives it, it still sounds mysterious, but it sounds even sadder. Like G sharp minor is such a, it's not as sad as B flat minor or E flat minor for that matter, but you're still using a lot of flat, you're losing a lot of the black keys. And so it has this kind of like yearning kind of quality to it, is kind of how I interpret that. And since this is kind of a yearning for innocence in your childhood, it fits with the song for sure.
Wouldn't it be great to travel back in time and just be a person in the back of that studio when she performed that live?
And I will say that watching this video, it makes me sad, and I've pointed this out before, it makes me sad that Kate hasn't done more performances like she did on The Tube with Under the Ivy, because it's just her and the piano. We don't need any of the other things. It's wonderful that, you know, for all the wonderful things that Kate loves to do with her theatrics and her choreography, that's all really cool. But, you know, we just want to see you sitting at your piano and playing and singing. And her doing that song and even moving it up to a different key and playing it a little differently, it shows that she can do it. But she just, you know, it's frustrating. It's just like, oh, you could have done this. What's wrong with you?
I don't have an answer to that one, Cecily.
I know. It's me like, yeah, more live stuff. But I am glad that this does exist.
Yeah, because I ended up going down a rabbit hole one afternoon with the Kate Bush YouTube mm-hmm. channel, because they're, I guess the default on YouTube is just to play them in the order of most recent to oldest, because things were not in any sort of curated order. At least it was easy to find under the ivy, but then you're just bouncing all over the place. But you sure do get to hear a lot of different styles and see a lot of different hairstyles and outfits and things over the years. But that's how it is with anybody. The fact that she performed it live on that show at the time on the Tube, I mean, obviously the album Hounds of Love had already been out for a while, so it's not like it was a song that she was hoping would be on Hounds of Love. But I don't know, like you said, I think it's confidence, because who does that? You know, you've got all these hits on Hounds of Love. I'm going to do one that's only available on the B-side, just mm-hmm. because I've realized in hindsight how awesome it is, simple it is, and she could just, if she wanted to, she could just show up and, yeah, I'll do a song for you. Watch this.
The Tube? No, as in, oh.
It was a TV show?
Yes. So it's on YouTube, introduced by Paula Yates, I think. And it's just a 2-minute video of her in her very 80s looking, massively wide-shouldered suit.
Oh my God, yes, so much hairspray. Anyway.
Well, it's one of the constant mysteries to me is that her hair and makeup can look spectacular, and then her dress sense is just all over the place. I don't know. Two separate advisors, I don't know.
This is the same person that wore, you know, I'm a prima donna in you, and then like leg warmers to a, you know, record store signing.
Yeah. I don't know.
Were you drunk when you did this? Anyway,
I think, well, I mean, to try and put a positive spin on it, I think you can see, I think particularly around maybe the Dreaming, she starts to dress in a less provocative way. I think a lot of those early videos, when I see them, I tend to cringe a little bit because she's just not wearing very much, and I don't think it's very dignified, and I don't think it helps the music very much either. And then there's some time in the early 80s when she starts wearing those kind of boxy linen suits or whatever they are, which I think makes a much more interesting statement. Like, she comes on Top of the Pops and does Hounds of Blood, no, Running Up That Hill, I beg your pardon, and she wears this kind of very grey, rectilinear looking, and she stands still, and it's brilliant, and it's just, that's a performance, and you don't need to do anything, you just need to be, and you just need to have this kind of grounded... Sorry, this is a massive tangent again, but I just thought it was interesting since it came up, you know. So this video, I think, is a nice example of that, of her, I think, letting the music speak for itself, I think, and just hanging back a bit with the video, with the visuals, because you don't need much. You just need to showcase the performance, and it's a really nice performance, and I really enjoy it.
Actually, the reason that we're here at Abbey Road Studios is not to do the Beatles. It's actually because we're doing Kate Bush. She had her first hit when she was 19, and it was... Can I have no peace? No peace. Anyway, Kate had her first hit with Wuthering Heights, and since then she's gone on from strength to strength and breaking completely new territories in music. She has also made her performances into something of an art form, mingling dance and mime and all kinds of theatre. In fact, she's a very thespian girl. So here we are, we're going to look at Kate Bush at Abbey Road Studios.
Take me long to tell you how to find it, to tell you where we'll meet. This little girl inside me is retreating to her favorite place. Go into the garden, go under the ivy, go under the leaves. Away from the party, go right to the rose, go right to the white rose. I sit here in the thunder, the green on the gray, I feel it all around me. It's not easy for to the garden, right to the rose, go right to the white rose.
Thank you so much for being on the show. It's always great to talk to you. Yay! I always like talking to other Kate fans. Oh my gosh. Yay.
Oh, I so much appreciate it, Cecily. Always great to be part of an episode of Strange Phenomena, because I listen to all of them and hear all the other thoughts. And it's just great to be on another episode, and especially during this era of Kate Bush. So, Cecily, thank you very much for having me on to be part of the show.
Mm-hmm. Of course. And where can people find you on social media?
I'm at Wayne Henderson on Twitter. On Facebook, I'm Wayne Henderson. And, of course, we're getting closer to hopefully finding out if my Green Bay Packers will make the playoffs this year. So if you're an NFL fan, you can check out my Packers Fan Podcast at PackersFanPodcast.com. Go, Pack, go.
Yay! Awesome, awesome. Well, thank you so much again. And I look forward to talking with you again on the show.
Awesome. Thanks, Cecily.
Well, I think we pretty much covered everything for Under the Ivy.
I think so, yeah. And yeah. I appreciate, you've made me think about that in a different way, which I really appreciate. Thank you.
Oh, I try. All right. Well, thank you so much for being on the show to talk about Under the Ivy. It was great to talk to you as always.
You're quite welcome. And it was great to talk to you too. And it would be nice to be back soon.
Thank you all so much for listening to this week's episode of Strange Phenomena, the Music of Kate Bush. Well, we got one B-side down. We went out into the garden. We went under the ivy. We went under the leaves, away from the party, and got to dissect a really beautiful song. I mean, I love this song. You all, I have yet to honestly meet a Kate fan who does not love this song. Anyway, speaking of favorite songs, next week, we're going to continue the B-sides. We're going to talk about B-side for Cloud Busting, the absolutely defiant Burning Bridge. And I'm going to get to talk about that with another Kate fan who's been on the show before. He's a young fan from California. His name is Diego Ortega. So I'm super excited to talk about that one. But first things first, if you are enjoying the show and you're like, ooh, I want to go support. Ooh, she has a Patreon. Ooh, where is it? Patreon.com/KateBushPodcast. You can see all sorts of cool rewards. You get an extra show. You actually get an extra show to go with all of your rewards and stuff. You can also follow me on Twitter at StrangeKateCast. You can follow me on Facebook, Facebook.com/KateBushPodcast. And you can email me, KBCast@LinkMedia.com. That is always link with an E, and also kbcast.linkmedia.com. You can find this thing anywhere on iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts. Feel free to rate and review. Hopefully good reviews. Hopefully happy reviews. And anyway, I'm really looking forward to next week. I hope you all will enjoy the episode coming out next week. We're going to get to talk about and not very mentioned song in Kate Bush's canon, Burning Bridge. See everybody then.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.